We're holding on Kuf Samach Zayin Amud Aleph, the third line. We've been talking throughout the perek so far about different dinim of shtaris and about different concerns of forgery or alteration in shtaris. So now the Gemara brings some examples of dinim and cases involving that kind of thing. Amar Abaya, when a person wants to show a sample of his signature to Beis Din. Now, why would he want to have to do that? Now, why would he do that? So the Rashbam explains, you have a situation like this. We know there's a, we've been talking about the concept of kiyum shtaris. You have a shtar with the two edim signed on it. Eventually, you want to validate that these really are their signatures. There's a number of ways of doing it. And one of them is that the edim themselves come to Beis Din and testify about their signatures. Now, what would happen, for example, the Gemara explains in Ksubas, suppose that you have, so Reuven and Shimon are signed on the shtar. Now, suppose Shimon is dead. Now, Reuven recognizes that this is Shimon's signature. But the problem is, what's going to happen? We're going to come to Beis Din. Reuven's going to say that I recognize my signature, and he, together with somebody else, is going to come and say that we recognize Shimon's signature. The problem with that is that then basically it comes out that three quarters of the validity of the shtar depends on Reuven. He himself is testifying about his own signature, which is half of what it's needed for it to be a valid shtar, and he's also joining with somebody else to testify about Shimon's signature. So it comes out that three quarters of the shtar, the concept of the shtar, is based on his edus, and we can't really do that. So what should we do? So Reuven will sign a sample of his signature and give it to Beis Din. Then Beis Din, they don't have to rely on Reuven's testimony to say this is my signature. They can compare it with what we see in the shtar, and then we have then we're good. Then Reuven plus somebody else can go and testify about Shimon's signature. So that would be an example that the that would be an example that Rashbam says where a person needs to file his signature with Beis Din. There are other examples as well. There could be a case, for example, where he wants his signature. There could be a case where he wants to have his signature on file with Beis Din. In fact, Rabbeinu Gershom says that we're talking about he just wants to have a signature on file in advance so that in the future, if a document comes with his signature, then the Beis Din will be able to compare it and then have to call him in. Whatever the case, so he's when he's doing that. So Abaya points out, Loi l'chavi b'soif megilta. He should not write that signature at the bottom of a piece of paper. Because somebody else afterwards might find that paper, the cost of the Masik Bezuzi, and he's going to write on it a whole document that says that Pliny owes him money. And now, even though there are no edim, it's still going to work to a certain extent. Utnan. Now we learn in a Mishnah later at the end of Arm at the end of Arm Masechta, Hoitzi Olav Ksav Yodei Shehu Chayev Loi, if a person brings out a shtar chayv that says that Pliny, that in his own handwriting, that in the other guy's own handwriting, that he owes him money, gave him a nechasim b'nei, then he's able to collect from nechasim b'nei. He's not able to collect from nechasim b'shabodim because there are no edim. But nevertheless, the fact that he himself, it's his, he had, there's his signature over here. Even though the rest of the shtar is written in a different handwriting, that doesn't matter. The fact that he signed on it is enough to be able to use it to collect from him, at least from Nechosim B'nei Chorin. So therefore, he's going to end up losing out. And therefore, Sabaya is telling him that is saying that you shouldn't do that. A question is though that the question is fine. So let's say this guy is going to bring the shtar to Beis Din. So what all this guy all the other guy needs to do is all the other guy needs to do who the paper was brought out against him. He could say, for example, poraiti. He could say, "I paid back." He could say, "I paid back the loan," or something like that. So, what are we so worried about? What's the fact is there was no loan over here in the first place. So, what is he? So he'll come and say that I. He'll come and say that I that. So first of all, actually, the Nemuka Yosef points out that yes, we would. It's true that he would be able to. He would be. We would believe him with a claim of migui. He could say that yes, I only signed on a blank piece of paper, and this guy added it later, and he has a migui that he could claim paraiti. Nevertheless, though, the problem is that he might say, "Just I never borrowed the money." And the Dayanim are going to say, yeah, but we have this paper over here that shows that you did. And therefore, then he's going to end up losing. He's going to end up losing unjustly. The Ritva gives a bit of a different answer. He may, he may say, I never borrowed money at all. And we have a concept in Halacha that says, Kola Omer, Loi Lovisi, Ka Omer Loi Paraiti. I mean, when a person says that I'd never borrowed this money, that's the equivalent of saying I never paid it back. Because if he didn't borrow it, then how did you pay it back? So therefore, so Beis Din is not going to believe his claim to say that I never borrowed the money, and therefore he's going to wind up losing out. So Abaya is saying the better idea is don't get yourself in that situation. Don't sign at the bottom of a paper where conceivably you could wind up in a situation like that. And in fact, the Gemara tells a story. Hahu Bazvina. There was a certain tax collector, a Yid. Bazvina, by the way, the Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out an interesting point. Where do we get the name Bazvina for a tax collector? He says Moloshin Bizbuz, like he causes people to waste and lose their money. I mean, if he's a Yiddish tax collector, there are strict dinim what he has to do in order not to be considered a gazlan. He's not allowed to take any more than he's allowed than he's required to by the government. Not all tax collectors were so honest, which is why we often have in the Gemara, they're often assumed to be Rishoyim. This one, as we're going to see in the story, was not quite such an honest guy either. So anyway, Bazvina means a tax collector. So he was a Yid. He comes to Abaya. Omele, he says, Nechsi limar chasimus yode. Rebbe, please give me a sample of your signature, Diki osu rabbonon, because this way in the future, when Chachomim come through the bridge where I collect the tolls, I will allow them to cross toll-free. In other words, what's going to happen? A person is going to come to the bridge. You're going to tell him, pay the toll. He's going to say, I have a letter from Abaya that I'm one of his Talmidim, and therefore that I should be able to go toll-free. So I'm going to say, okay, show me the paper. So now, how do I know that this is your signature? So Abaya, I want to have on file a signature of yours so that I can compare. Okay, so Abaya says, fine. Achvi le beresh megilta. So Abaya took out a piece of paper and started writing the signature at the top of it. Have a kanogid, babe. Meanwhile, as Abaya is signing, the guy or getting ready to sign, the guy is trying to like surreptitiously, like without Abaya noticing, pull the paper down so that Abaya will sign further down on the paper, and then he'll be able to use it for this kind of purpose. So Abaya says, "I'm one step ahead of you. The Chacham are way ahead of you that they said not to sign further down because of this concern. So don't think you're getting away with it." I know what you're doing over here. There was an interesting story that's told in this connection with the Dayan Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Fisher, one of the Dayanim of the Eda Achredis in Yerushalayim. There are two people who had lived together as chavrusis for a long time, and one day Reuven tells Shimon, years ago I lent you $10,000. You see, you have to pay it back. I never borrowed such an amount from you. I have a shtar here with a signature. To make a long story short, so the Dayan calls in Shimon and asks him, did you ever lend any sforim to Reuven? Yeah, I'm sure I must have lent him some sforim. Do you remember? No, I don't remember which sforim. And he goes back and forth over there. Anyway, so the Dayan tells him, you have to bring me all your sforim or look through all of them yourself. What does sforim have to do with it? And the Dayan explains, I think what might have happened is something like this, that Reuven borrowed a sefer from you previously. You had your name written on the flyleaf. He cut out that page and wrote above it a shtar saying that he owes you money. And sure enough, Shimon finds a sefer that he'd previously lent to Reuven, and the title page was cut out. So exactly that he'd written his name in the middle or towards the bottom of the page, and now Reuven tried to use that against him, but the Dayan was able to figure it out that was the situation, and he was able to get Reuven to admit that he had forged the whole thing.
That's a chavrusa for learning.
That's a chavrusa for learning. Listen, even a chavrusa for learning unfortunately has a yetzahara, but okay. So the Gemara goes on. Omar Abaya. So Abaya says, here's more dinim and more recommendations as far as writing a shtar to avoid alterations. Mitzlas vad eser. When you have any number between 3 and 10, So you borrowed three dinarim or whatever. Don't write that number at the end of a line. Because Duma Mizayef for Kosav, because he might alter it and he might write something extra. You write the word shalosh, for example. All you have to do is add a yud mem and you have the word shloshim, and now it's 10 times as much. And the same thing with arba, arboim. And in Aramaic, it's very similar. Tosfos points out, actually, if you're writing tlossa in Aramaic, for example, then there might be less of an issue, because then you have an aleph over there and you can't make it into tlossin, which would be 30. So we're talking about if you wrote it in Loshon Nekeva, if you wrote tlas, where then it could easily be transformed into tlossin. Now the Rashbam points out, if it was achad oser, then there's no problem, because to write achad oser, if he wants to alter it, he would have to write echad v'esrim. So fine, the yud mem at the end, he might be able to get away with, but the vav he would have to squeeze in. And as the Gemara is going to go on to say. When you see letters that are squeezed in where there seems to not be as much room around them as you would expect, then you start suspecting that something's wrong over here. But the point is, a shtar, now like this, I guess, you know, if the shtar is written with the lines justified, like you often have, for example, in Ksubas, they make sure the lines are lined up at the beginning and the end, maybe there's less of an issue with it, because then why would you have one line punk sticking out? But we're talking about the pashtus. You write things like where it's justified on one side, but then it's the lines just end wherever they end on the other side, and then you don't know whether this yud mem or yud nun was part of the original or whether it was added later. Achronim talk about to what extent does it, now maybe even here Tosfos is saying that if you wrote, for example, tlossa with an aleph at the end, then you have no issue with it, because then he's not going to be able to change it into tlossin, although other mafoshim disagree with that and say maybe even there is still the concern that he might erase the aleph and write in a yud nun in there. And there's also discussion about to what extent does this apply in different languages. Also, you know, in English, you have much the same thing. For example, you could write six at the end of the line, and it could be transformed into 6D, etc. So Duma Mizayef for Kosef. So again, he might forge, he might alter, and add extra letters. The E Isramile. Now, what happens? You're writing the shtar, and punct, it happens that the number does end up at the end of the line. So then, Nahadri Lidibure Train Tlossazimni. Repeat that number two or three times in the body of the shtar. As it is, we talked about yesterday that often things are repeated in a shtar anyhow. So like this, make sure several times in the shtar to write the number that he lent him. So you're going to say, for example, you know, on day such and such, Reuven borrowed three dinarim from Shimon. And then he said, these three dinarim that I borrowed from you, then I promised that I'm going to pay them back by such and such a time, or whatever, you know. So you repeat that number as many times as necessary. Inevitably, at some point, it'll come out in the middle of a line, and then that way, and as we learned before in the Mishnah, that generally you go according to what it says at the bottom of the shtar. Only we said when that part is erased, then we reconstruct it based on the top part. So here, by repeating it several times in the shtar, you're gonna have the tachtoid, which we're gonna say you're gonna follow that. And there it says three, for example, and then you're gonna know that then you don't really have to worry about whether the 30 up above was altered or not. It wouldn't really matter. You wouldn't go according to it anyway, because as we looked before, it all goes according to the tachtoid. One point is where the reason why we're mentioning from 3 to 10, but Pashtus you would say, because with the number Shnayim or Train in Aramaic, you can't easily transform it into the number for 20. But also Rabbeinu Gershom points out another thing as well. If you only borrowed one coin, you're going to say, for example, Sela. If you wrote two, you're going to say Sloim. Either way, we're not going to write a number. So you can't really transform it into a larger number. And to say that if it says Sela, then you have to be concerned he might transform it into Sloim. Rabbeinu Gershom says that, listen, for the profit of one Sela, he's not necessarily going to bother. Fine. Continues the Gemara. There was a case of a shtar, of a shtar mekach. Somebody had written out a shtar that he'd sold, that he'd sold property to somebody else. And he wrote in there that he'd sold him tilta bipardesa, one third within the orchard that I have. Bipardesa in the orchard. I'm selling one third of it to Pliny. Also, the guy, the buyer went, he went and erased and rubbed out the top of the bays and the bottom of the bays. So what was left looked like a vav. You have left a little bit of, you have left a little bit of the side of the bays, and therefore that looked like a vav. Vishavi upardesa. Then he made it, so that changes the word from bipardesa to upardesa and a garden. So in other words, he's saying that, So now he's coming and claiming that you sold me your entire garden, that you sold me one, that tilta upardesa, one third, meaning one third of your other property, plus the entire orchard. Also kabed Abaya, the case came to Abaya, Omale, and Abaya looks at the shtar and he says, my time revich le almalahai vav. Why is there so much space around this vav? The fact that there's extra space between the vav and the rest of the word, paudesa, means there must be something wrong over here. Kafse, so Abaya had him tied up to give him malchus, va'odi, and he was mezah, and he was moida, that in fact that he had altered it. Now, an interesting point over here is that what if the guy hadn't end up in it? First of all, the Yad Ramah talks about actually what gives a buyer the right to threaten the guy with malchus when it's only a suspicion like that. So the Yad Ramah says that's exactly it. When a dayan realizes has reason to suspect that there's something fishy over here, then he does have the ability to force the person to admit. On the other hand, the Meiri says that maybe not. Maybe it doesn't mean he was actually going to give him malchus, but just he started making it as though he was going to, and the guy got scared, and admitted. An interesting point in that regard would be, what if he hadn't admitted? Then would we still say the shtar is valid? So the Ritva actually writes that it might taka have been. That yes, we're seeing that there's a space over there, but that doesn't necessarily mean, in fact, even the fact, now normally you would say, we learned the other day, for example, that if you have something erased in a shtar, or you have something put between the lines where it was missed out and then you filled it in afterwards, you're supposed to have at the end of a shtar kiyum, you're supposed to have a statement that this is how it is in the shtar itself. Here you don't have a kiyum on this. Nevertheless, the Ritva says it might still be good anyway, because we're talking about, let's say, what taka wasn't noticeable. If there was noticeable that there was an erasure there, would be one thing. But apparently the guy had done his job well, and it really looked like it was blank parchment, except the only thing is Abaya was sharp-eyed and noticed that the vav had extra space around it that didn't belong over there. But only because he forced him to admit, then therefore the truth came out. Had it not been for that, had the guy not admitted, then he might have actually gotten away with it. So the point is, in other words, a dayan has a responsibility to look at this kind of thing, to notice when there are letters that are crowded in or spaced out more than normal, and to realize there might be something fishy going on over here. And the Gemara gives another example, the other way around. There was a shtar that said that Reuven and Shimon, who are brothers, have a portion of land in such and such a place, and we're selling it to Pliny. Reuven and Shimon, in addition, had another brother whose name was Achi. Now, the nusach of the shtar was Reuven v'Shimon Achi, Reuven and Shimon, who are brothers. Now, this guy who had bought the property from them, he realized he has an opportunity over there. They have a brother named Achi. Also, kosev bevav. He put an extra vav before the word achi, v'shavye ve'achi. Now he turned the word into ve'achi, which means, in other words, that now he's saying that he bought the portions belonging to Reuven and Shimon and Achi. Also, the kamei d'Abaya, so the shtar was brought to Abaya, omalei, and Abaya says, my time adochakle amalahai vav kolahai, why is this vav so crowded in? Again, kafse, he tied him up to give him malchus, v'odi, and the guy admitted that he had falsified the shtar. So they're the same kind of thing in reverse. With the previous one, it was too much space around the letter. Here, it was too little. Either way, a Dayan has to be sharp-eyed and look out for such things. Another example. There was a shtar brought to Beis Din where Rava had signed. There were the signatures of it of Rava and Rav Acha bar Ada as Edim Bapashtos, so maybe as Dayanim, whatever. Also the Kameda Rava. So the bearer of the shtar brought it to Rava for Kiyum Shtaris. Omale, so Rava says, Dein Chasimus Yudodidihi. Yes, this is my signature. Mihu, however, this is not my signature because Kameder of Achaba'ada, like Chasimi Lima Olam. I never signed ahead of Rav Achabar Ada because he is older than me and I would give him covered and have him sign first. So this shtar that has my signature first, it can't possibly be my signature. Kafse, so again, Rava tied him up to give him petch, but Odi and the guy was moide that he had forged the signatures. Omale, so Rava asks him, Bishlema didi zaifus. I can understand how you were able to forge my signature. Because I have a regular handwriting, so fine. You know, you've looked at enough of my signatures, you've figured out, you can see my handwriting and you can copy it. Ela de Achaba Ada de Rosis Yode, but of Achaba Ada, he's old and his hands shake when he writes. Hechi Abdus, how were you able to forge a signature like that, which is in a shaky handwriting? Omar, so the guy answers, Anchi Yodoi Amatsra. I put my hand on a matzra. A matzra is a type of rope bridge. You have the not really rope bridge. It's when you want to cross a river and they don't have a permanent bridge in place. They have like a plank of wood going across the river, and then they have next to it they have a rope tied alongside it to serve as a handrail, so that when you're walking on this plank, you have the rope to hold on to while you're crossing. So now the guy's saying, what I did is to forge the shtar, I put my hand on that rope rail, and as people are walking over the bridge, the whole thing is shaking and vibrating, and therefore I was able to copy a shaky handwriting that way. The Amri Law, others say that what he told Rava is Kama Zarnuka Vakosav. He stood on top of a Zarnuka and wrote. A Zarnuka is a bottle or a bag made out of skin, made out of leather that they would use for drawing water. When it's inflated, it's very unstable. Think of in modern terms, like standing on top of a on top of an inflated beach ball or on top of a bean bag or whatever. It's wobbly. So the same way, it was wobbly, and therefore he's able to forge a crooked signature like that, a shaky signature. One thing we learn from this story then is, first of all, again, that the Dayanim, like Rava, have to be sharp and be able to understand the different ways in which forgers are able to do their jobs, and that way they're able to catch them. In this particular case, also, one thing we see from it is also, if the guy had realized about the covered you have to have for an elder Talmud Chacham, then he would have put Rav Acha Ba'ada's forged signature first and Rava's second, and Rava might never have caught on to it. Again, you have an interesting point over here about what would have happened if Rava had not caught on to it. Obviously, he would have gotten away with it. But what if the guy had not been moide? Now, the Rambam holds an interesting point. The Rambam brings a point that when a person is coming to Beis Din and testifying about his signature, he has to at least remember that the thing happened. In other words, he's not just coming to say, this is my signature. He has to be saying, yes, I do remember that Reuven lent Shimon money or whatever, and yes, I can validate that this is my signature. If not, then the Rambam says, just that he's coming to say this is my signature without remembering the actual Maisa is worthless. In fact, the Rambam says very sharply over there, he says, anybody who doesn't judge like that has no idea, Ben Yeminil is Smirli, has no difference, he doesn't even understand his right from his left when it comes to Dini Mominus. The Raiva disagrees with the Rambam on that, but the point is, in other words, so according to the Rambam, even if the guy hadn't been Moida, the very fact, yes, Rava is saying this is my signature, but he also obviously didn't remember the thing that the Eidos is on because it never happened. So therefore, so according to the Rambam, anyway, even if the guy hadn't been murder, we would have caught him out, and we would have said, even if we hadn't caught him out as a forger, we would have at least said, look, the shtar is not valid because I, Rava, do not remember the thing that's written in the shtar at all. The Ivan disagrees on that. Look, you have a shtar, it has your signature. What do we care whether you remember or not? And the Ritva says that, you know, here we see, on the other hand, we see from the story in the Gemara over here, had the guy not been murdered, he might have gotten away with it. Okay, maybe the Ritva is saying that at least Rava, here Rava is only saying, I don't remember ever signing in front of Rav Acha Ba'ada, so therefore maybe we would say, well, that doesn't really matter. That's not something that would pass all the shtar. If he had said, maybe conceivably, if Itaka said, I don't remember the event at all, which of course he couldn't because it never happened, then maybe the Ritva would also agree that it's not valid. Okay. Mishnah says, Kosvin get ish afa pishein ishto imai. You can write a get for a husband even when his wife is not with him. So you can write it, you can sign it, and he'll use it whenever he wants. It doesn't matter whether his wife is there, because after all, midin Torah, a woman can be divorced by korcha. Nowadays that we have that a woman can't be divorced by korcha because of chayim de ben egoshim. Nevertheless, I looked briefly in Shulchan Aruch. I didn't notice anything to the effect that this halacha has changed because of that. So but pastors, the idea is fine. You can only be megarisher by korcha. You can only be megarisher by tzayna. But nevertheless, though the get can be prepared in advance, and when he gives it to her, it's going to have to be by tzayna. Fine. Vashuvah leisha. Now, on the other hand, we have when it comes to a receipt for the wife, she's going to write out a receipt that he paid her off for ksuba. That kind of thing you can write for her afal pi shein baila ima, even though her husband is not with her. Because again, the point is that the husband's not losing out anything of it. She's the one who stands to lose from it. If she loses that shtar and the husband finds it, he's going to be able to say, "Look, I paid you off your ksuba already." So if she wants to have the shtar written in advance and hold on to it until it's ready, because don't hate. She can do that. Ovelvad shehei makiran, provided that the sofer and the edim, we're going to see in the Gemara who they have to recognize, but the pashtus, it means that the sofer and the edim have to recognize them. They have to know that this is the actual, that this is the actual husband and the actual wife that we're dealing with. In other words, because we're going to learn in the Gemara, otherwise you might have other people who pretend to be them and have these documents written out or something like that, as we'll see in the Gemara. Tosfos deals with the question that in the case of the get, for example, what if he writes it early and that creates a problem as far as payrus of her nichsim alug, where as soon as he decides to divorce her, even when he decides to divorce her, he's still entitled to payrus from her nichsim alug until he actually divorces her, and then you're going to have a shtar, a get that's predated months in advance, and he's going to claim that he can take away those payrus from them, etc. So Tosfos discusses that the point, it's one thing when you have, if the shtar is lost, and then if the get is lost and then found, then we have the question of whether, in fact, it was written earlier. But now, normally, a person does not write, the expression in the Gemara in a few places is, le'maktim inish puronusa l'nafshe, a person does not usually go ahead of time and create a puronus and write something which is not so good for him to divorce his wife. So therefore, so when anyway, as it is, we have a reyus, we have a weakness in it because it was lost and found, and that itself maybe shows it's not the genuine article, because then he would have been more careful with it. Then we have to be choshish that maybe it was predated, but otherwise not. If he wants to write it a day or two before he gives it to her, then fine, he could do that. Then as far as the shoivu, you have the question also, what happens if it's predated, and Tosfos deals with things about that, one of them being that once it's signed, then already with the get, you have, it has to be given to her, v'nosan b'yada. But with the other kinds of shtaris that we're dealing with here in the Mishnah, most of them are things in dinei mominus. There we can say, edim b'chasum of zochin loy, as soon as the edim sign it, then already it takes effect. So therefore, so in short, you can write the get for the husband without the wife being there. It doesn't matter because he'll just hold on to it until he's ready to use it. And similarly, the shover, she'll hold on to it until she's ready to use it. It might be predated. In the case of the get, we assume it's not dated that far in advance because lo makdim inish puronus l'nafshe. In the case of the shover, as soon as it's signed, it takes effect anyway. So therefore, as of the date when it was signed. So continues the Mishnah. V'habal noisin schar. The husband is the one who pays the sofer to write the get, for reasons that the Gemara is going to explain, which we'll learn tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. Now, as far as the shover, the Rashbam points out, after all, it's his chus, because the whole point of the shover is that if later on she wants to collect her ksuba, he pulls out the shover and says, look, it shows that I already paid you, the ksuba. So therefore, in both cases, he's the one. So the reason why he pays for the get, we're going to learn in the Gemara tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. And the reason why he pays for the shover, the Rashbam says, is partially because he's the one who's gaining from it. On the other hand, Rishonim talk about that in a place where there is a minhag to actually write the ksuba, as we've learned previously, notably in Masechet Ksubas, we talked about in some places they would have a minhag to actually write a ksuba. Nowadays, that's pretty much universal, whereas in other places they didn't have the minhag to actually write it. They were just relying on the Takonas Chachamim that there is an amount to be paid for the ksuba. So now the Rashba and other Rishonim discuss the point that we have to be talking about over here, where it's a place where they don't regularly write a ksuba, and therefore it's important for him to have that shover. Otherwise, she could try to claim it again and again. If it's a place where the ksuba is written, then as long as she's paid the ksuba, she would have to give it to him, and even if she loses the ksuba, and therefore she needs, so ordinarily, in other words, no shover would be needed for paying off the ksuba anyhow, because normally, as long as the ksuba is in her hand, we assume it hasn't been paid, and once she returns it to him, then there you go, it's been paid, and that's that, and he holds on to it from then on. The whole concept where you need a shover is either in a place where the ksuba is not written in the first place, or where a ksuba is written, and she says, I lost my ksuba. Well, if it's that she lost her ksuba, that shouldn't obligate the husband to pay for a sofer to write a shover. Therefore, so then she would have to pay for it. So therefore, so the Rashba and other Rishonim learn that we're talking about when we say that he pays for the shover means specifically in a case where they don't have, in a place where they don't have the minhag to actually have a written ksuba. So therefore, there's no choice. A shover has to be written. Otherwise, she's going to come and claim the ksuba again and again. And therefore, it's his benefit to have a shover, and therefore, he's the one who pays for it. With that said, Rabbeinu Gershom actually Taka explains that when we say Havabal Noisin Schar is referring only to the get, not the shover, because instead of saying that we're talking about the shover in a specific case, you're right. Ordinarily, the wife would pay for the shover if there's one going to be needed, but it's only the get that always the husband is going to be paying for reasons that we're going to talk about in the Gemara tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. Okay, the Mishnah continues. You can write a shtar for a loiva that he wants to use to have available for when he's going to borrow money, even though the malva is not with him. Because same idea, he wants to have it in advance. He wants to have it available in advance, so that when he comes to the guy to borrow money, the guy doesn't say, "New, where is a shtar? I'm not lending you without a shtar." So he'll have the shtar pre-written already and ready for that purpose. Again, you have the question about. Tosfos refers to the Gemara in Bava Metzia that deals with the question. Fine, but what if he decided not to borrow the money right now, and then you have the shtar is predated, and that creates all kinds of problems with the lakuchas and the shibud and all that. And so Tosfos brings from the Gemara over there. There's two possibilities: either we're talking about a shtar that has a kinyan written in it, or. So he's making already a shibud as of when the shtar is written, even if he doesn't borrow the money. Or you have the concept that Abaya says Eidim b'chasum of zochin loy. As soon as the Eidim sign it, then right away it takes effect, and you have the shibud takes effect, and therefore that works even if he only actually borrows the money later. Now, so the Mishnah continues. On the other hand, the ein kosvin lamalva ad shehe loiva imay. On the other hand, you cannot write a shtar chov for a malva unless the loiva is with him. You have to ask. I mean, that's fairly obvious. I mean, otherwise everybody's going to write a shtar without the loiva with him and claim that he owes him money, and it's flat out edus sheker. So the Ritva says two things. First of all, you're right. There might not be a chiddush. The Mishnah is just mentioning it, having mentioned that you can write for the loiva without the malva, so it mentions the other side of it as well. Also, the point is, even if the Edim saw the actual loan unless the loiva tells them go write a shtar, then they can't write one. So therefore, so we're saying in kos from lamalva, adshi hey loiva imoy. If they saw Reuven lending Shimon the money, and but Shimon didn't tell them to write the shtar, and later on Reuven says to them, you know, now that you saw me lending Shimon that money, let's write out a shtar. The point of the Mishnah is they can't do that. Shimon has to be present and has to give or has to give permission for them to write the shtar. Continues the Mishnah, v'haloiva noisin schar, and in the case of a shtar halva, it's the loiva that pays for the document. Again, because he's having the hana. Now that seems fairly obvious, and therefore the Gemara is going to explain. We'll learn tomorrow, Best Hashem, what the chiddush of that is. Next. Similarly, when it comes to a shtar of a sale, you can write the shtar for the seller even though the buyer is not with him, because again, that's a, if he wants to take his chances on that, that he might lose the shtar, that's his problem. But not vice versa. You can't write for the lekeach unless the seller is with him, because obviously then there's a then you have the possibility of fraud. Again, there might not be as much of a chiddush in that, or it might be that even it means that again they sold a transaction, then we still need him to give permission to write it. Valakeach noisin schar, and it's the buyer who pays for the who pays the sofer for the cost of writing the shtar, again because he's the one who's gaining the benefit from it. Which again we'll learn in the Gemara tomorrow. What's the chiddush of that? It seems obvious that he should have to be the one who pays for it. Okay, continues the Mishnah. Ein kosvin shtori erusin. Now, when it comes to shtoris of erusin v'nisuin, so the mechutanim cannot write. The shtar erusin would be the tnoyim, basically. The shtar nisuin would be the ksuba. Those can be written elamidas shnehen. Those can be written only with the consent of both of them. So unlike, for example, with the malva and the loiva, or the buyer and the seller, where you can have it written in advance, and you'll just use it when it comes time. But when it comes to these shtaris, you need both of them to agree at the time, because each one is taking responsibilities on themselves responsibilities to the other. Now there is a different. Now here we're saying that shtari erusin, the Rashbam is explaining, means basically a tnoyim, where they're agreeing on the financial obligations of each side in terms of making the wedding. There is actually a different explanation in a Gemara elsewhere that it means the shtar erusin would be, we know that you can be makadish b'kesef shtar b'biyah, so the shtar would mean, in other words, where he writes out a shtar that says hareat makudeshesli, and according to that the vort is that both the chosin and kala have to agree for that shtar to be written. So that has to be written midas shnehem avachosin noisin schar, and it's the chosin who pays the sofer for writing the shtaris, because he's the one who gains the benefit from it. He's the one who's marrying the kala. He's the one who's getting who's getting rights to her property and so forth. So therefore, he has more hana from this wedding than she does. Obviously, she's gaining from it as well, but he's gaining more, and therefore he's the one who would have to pay for the ksuba and for the tnoyim and whatever to be written. And again, we'll see in the Gemara tomorrow, Best Hashem, that there is a chiddush in that. Next, in kosvin shtar arisus v'kablonus elamidas shnehem. Then we have a shtar of arisus, where Reuven has a field, and he makes a deal with Shimon that you will be my oris, and you will work the field and do everything to cultivate it, and you'll get a certain percentage of the crops. So they write a shtar about that. Well, kablonus is the same thing, except that instead of being a percentage, it's a fixed amount that you're going to pay of crops, a fixed amount of crops per year. So then those kinds of things also, elamidas shneim, such a shtar can be written only with the consent of both of them, because again, each one is taking a chiyuv, each one is accepting on himself a chiyuv in it. Unlike, for example, with a malva and a loiva, the loiva is accepting on himself the chiyuv, the malva is not. But the same thing with a sale. But here, both sides are accepting the chiyuv on themselves. I will work your field, and I will give you X% of the crops of the field, etc. So therefore, so it has to be written. And it's the oris or the kablon, the worker who's going to be paying the sofer for having the shtar written, because again, he's the one who's getting the most hana out of it. Another din, ein kosven shtore birurin v'chol maise beistin. When it comes to writing shtore birurin, which we're going to see in the Gemara tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, what shtore birurin are, there's a couple of different opinions, v'chol maise beistin, or any other document that describes what beistin did. So the Rashbam gives an example of that would be an adrachta. Where you have part of the process when a Baal Choy is collecting from real estate, you have a whole process that it goes through before he actually gets it. At one point, one of the parts of the process is they write an adrachta, which basically says to the Malva, you're entitled to go look around for any property, for any real estate that currently belongs to the Loiva, or that used to belong to him and which he sold since the loan was taken out, and then you can be Torif, and you'll be able to be Torif from that. So that kind of shtar is called an adrachta. So it's an example of a maisa based in. It's a report of what based in decided. So that kind of thing, elamidas shnehem, such a thing can only be written with the consent of both of them, or shnehem noisim skar, both of them have to pay the sofer. They pay him jointly. Reb Shimon Gamliel Omer l'shneim kosven shneim lazela atzmei lazela atzmei. Reb Shimon Gamliel says that actually they write two different shtaros, one for each one of them. Each one has his own shtar, and therefore each one is paying for his own shtar, as we'll see in the Gemara. As we'll see in the Gemara tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. What shtore berurin are, and what these kind of shtores are that we're dealing with, and why Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying that they would need two separate shtores rather than one joint shtar. So we'll see about all that point tomorrow. But meanwhile, we'll deal now with the first part of the Mishnah, with the earlier parts of the Mishnah. So the Gemara says, "My uvadshi hey makiron." What do we mean? In the Mishnah, we said that you can write the get for the husband or the shtoiver for the wife, even when the other party is not present. We said, Ovadshi hey makiron, as long as he recognizes them. So who do they need to recognize? Omer of Yehuda, Omer Rav, Ovadshi hey makir shema ish, the get, the shema ish of a shtoiver. It means that the sofer and each of the edim have to know the name. They have to know that this man is actually name actually has such and such a name when it comes to a get. Because the point is, and similarly, the wife with the shover. The point is that Rashbam says otherwise. For example, what might happen is that a person comes and commissions the sofer and the edim to write a get and using somebody else's name. And then he's going to give it to some other woman, and she'll be able to use it to collect her, ksuba. The Rashbam refers to, there's a Mishnah in Masechet Ksubas that says that if the wife produces a get, even if she doesn't have a ksuba, then she's still entitled to collect her ksuba, because why would she have the get unless she had actually been divorced, and therefore she's entitled to her ksuba. So now Reuven might come to a sofer and bring along Edim and say, I plan to divorce my wife Rochel. I want you to write a shtar in the name. And he doesn't tell them his name is Reuven. He tells him my name is Shimon ben Levi, and my wife is Rochel bas Lavan, and I want a shtar written, and I want a shtar written on the, I want to get written on those names, and they're going to do that, and then he's going to give it to her, and she's going to you, and then he's going to give it to a woman of that name and use it to collect her ksuba falsely, and the same way with the receipt. The Edim need to know that this is the Edim, and the Sofer need to know that this is the actual, that the one who's commissioning it is the actual one named in it. Where the other way around, you're going to have a man who previously divorced his wife is going to be given this shover, and then he's going to be able to use it to say, look, when you come to collect your ksuba, sorry, I already paid you, and here's the shover to that effect. So Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav is saying that therefore that's the concern. So we have to know. So we don't have to. It's true that the Mishnah doesn't mean you have to know both of them. It's not important that the sofer and the edim know who the wife is. Even so, as long as when it comes to a get, that is. So for example, a get, Reuven comes to Beis Din, not to Beis Din, he comes to the sofer and asks him to write him a get. As long as they know that he is Reuven ben Yaakov, who's named in this get, then they can go ahead and write it for him, and they don't have to be concerned that we don't know who his wife is, the name that he's writing in the get, and vice versa with the shover. But that's it. So the Gemara says Yosef. So Yosef, Rav Safra, Rav Acha Bar Huna, Rav Huna Bar Chinina. These three Chachamim were sitting together. The Yosef Abaya Gabayu, Abaya was sitting together with them. The Yasu become a boy lahu, and they were sitting and wondering like that. So based on what Rav Yehuda is saying, Shem ha'ish beget ein, so it sounds like the Sofer and the Edom have to know that this man who's commissioning the get is the actual man who's named in the get, but implying Shema Ishaloi, implying they don't have to know the woman, that they don't have to know that this is the woman mentioned. Shema Isha b'shover ein, Shema Ishaloi, and vice versa with the shover. It sounds like they have to know, since she's the one who's commissioning it. Again, we want to avoid this possibility of fraud, that she's going to have the shover written and give it to somebody else and use it to defraud his wife. So therefore, we want to make sure that she's the one who's actually named in the shover. But Shema Ishloi, they were saying the implication is they don't have to know the name of the husband. These four Chachamim, Reb Safra, Reb Acha Bar Huna, Reb Huna Bar Chinina, and Abaya, We're all sitting there and wondering, well, why not? Leichosh duma kosev gita. Why don't we have the concern that Reuven may have a get written in the name name of somebody else's wife? Then he's going to give it to Pliny's wife and claim that she'll claim that she's divorced, and then she's going to collect huksuba in, and then she's going to collect huksuba inappropriately. So in other words, it's not just a matter of that. It's not just a matter of that that it may be used to falsely collect a ksuba or whatever you might have. He actually gives it to another woman, and she uses it to falsely claim that she was divorced and that she can collect a ksuba. And vice versa with the shoiver. So you should need to know both names. And similarly, and as far as the shoiver, the zimnin ozlov akos v'isha shoiver, a woman might go and write a shoiver with another man's name that's not her husband. V'yahavel gavra delav delay, she's going to give it to a man to a man other than her husband, and he's going to use it to claim that he paid off his ksuba. So how can you say it's enough to know one side and that would be it? So actually now that Rashbam explains that what he's going to use is he's going to use the get. When we say over here, we're going to say over here. So the gusa we have in front of us in the Gemara over here is just for Ozol Mamtila Itse Deheach. He may give it to Pliny's wife. It doesn't say what she's going to do with it. Now the Hagoris HaBach adds the words, and then the Rashbam had these words also in the Gemara, Umagarash Law, and he's going to use it to divorce her. You're going to end up, in other words, that we're going to think that she's divorced when in fact she was not, because the get wasn't written Lishmoy V'Lishma. Tosfos actually wonders anyway, the get has to be given in front of Edim, and they have to read the get verbally before they give it. So then they're going to realize that there's something wrong over here. So Tosfos says, you're right. It's not so much that we're concerned it may be inappropriately used to divorce, but actually it is. What it means, in other words, is that since they don't know who the wife is, so he might, the Edim, again, we're assuming that the Sofer and the Edim only know who the husband is, who's commissioning it, and they know that this is his name, but not the wife. So they might actually write the get for somebody else who has the same name as him, and then he's going to give it to someone, and then he's going to give it to that other person, and sure, fine, she may not use it to claim that she's divorced, because she's going to know she's going to be in trouble if she tries that. So she's going to end up eventually, if we find out that that tricks were played over here, then she's in serious trouble as an Ashes Ish who got remarried. But the point is, she's going to use it to try to falsely collect her ksuba. So isn't that a concern as well, and vice versa with the shover? The Hagoris HaBach has a long piece over here analyzing this further, what other concerns there might be in this case. So the point is, how can we say that it's enough for the Sofer and the Edim to know that the husband who's coming to commission the get actually is named as it says in the get, and similarly with the woman with the shover, when there is this possibility of fraud in these other ways as well? Abaya says to them, as a matter of fact, when Rav said this din originally, which Rav Yehuda had quoted in his name, it means Shema Ish Beget. When it says they need to know the man's name as far as the get, it does mean Vahua din the Shema Isha. It doesn't mean like you were thinking that it means only they have to know his name and we don't care whether they know her name. No, it means they actually have to know both. Similarly, Shema Ish B'Shoiva, V'hu Adin L'Shema Ish. The same way, they have to also know the man's name as well. In both cases, you're right. They actually have to. They do have to know. They do have to know that this actual man and this actual woman. And otherwise it's no good. Otherwise they can't write it. It doesn't matter whether both of them are present, but they have to know that this man who's coming over here and calling himself Reuven ben Yaakov and having a get written for Rochel bas Lavan is actually that he's actually married to her, and we know who they are, and just Rochel herself doesn't have to be present. So Tosfos says, in that case, then why did Rav use that phrasing, Shema Ish Beget, Shema Isha B'Shover, when according to what Abaye is saying, it means it's actually both of them? So Tosfos says, because we're talking about that, we're saying the Mishnah had mentioned that the Mishnah was referring to saying that a man can have a get written without his wife present, and the woman can have a shover written without her husband present. So we mean, in other words, so Rav was following that same terminology and using the same thing, because we already mentioned them, so therefore we're mentioning them again. But again, as Abaye is saying, it does actually mean that they need to know the other ones as well. The Ramban gives a different explanation of it, that Rav is saying the chiddush in each one. Of course, when he wants to write a get, we need to know what his wife's name is, because I have to write the name. For sure, no question, when the woman has a shover written, we have to know who the husband is. But we might think that maybe we don't need the husband himself is coming to write the get. Maybe we don't need to know that you are who you say you are. Who cares? You're coming and having a get paid for. Why would they even bother giving a false name? So therefore, so Rav is saying, no, the chiddush is you have to know his name in case there's this possibility of fraud, but how much more so you have to know the other one's name, because after all, the get has to be written l'shma, and so forth. All right. So the Gemara asks, now, you're telling me then that as long as the Edom know that this guy is named Reuven ben Yaakov, for example, or to use the example that the Gemara is going to now use over here, Yosef ben Shimon, then you know, then that's fine. As long as you know that's his wife's name, then you can write the get. The question is, v'leichush l'shnei Yosef and Shimon hadorim be'irachas. Don't we have to be concerned that there might be two people named Yosef ben Shimon who are both living in the same city? So in other words, so now what happens is that the Rashbam explains, you might have a Yosef ben Shimon came from another city where his real name is not Yosef ben Shimon, but rather Reuven ben Yaakov. Now he pretends to go now. So now he goes over here. And he takes on a new name where he is, because he wants to pretend to be somebody else. He wants to impersonate somebody else and have the guy's wife divorced. So Duma Kosev Gita, maybe he might have a get written, and then he's going to go bring it to the other guys. So we have two Yosef and Shimons. So now one of them might have a get written, and they're going to. The part about the different city, about altering names, that's going to be the next part of the Gemara. Here we're dealing with, in one city, we have two people named Yosef and Shimon. Now, so either one of them can go to the Edim. He can say, write me a get in the name of Yosef and Shimon, and they'll do that because they know who he is. And the problem is, then he's going to go give it to the other Yosef and Shimon's wife. And then she's going to use it to claim that she's allowed to get married and that she can collect her ksuba and so forth. Tosfos deals with the point, actually, that the Gemara talks about in various places. We're going to touch on it later in the Perek, that only when we have a chazakah. So what are we dealing with over here? Tosfos says, when we have a chazakah, when we know that there are two Yosef and Shimons here in town, then anyway, we need to add something to the get to make it clear which Yosef and Shimon it is. We add their grandparents' name or whatever, or according to Rabbi Lazar, Edim is Sita Kauti. It doesn't matter. You can just write the names themselves, and you rely on the Edim who are seeing it being given over.
And her name's the same also?
Let's assume her name is the same as well, yeah.
And then you mentioned before that she has to give it with Edis.
Right, so that's the point. In other words, the Tosfos says that's the question. If we know that there are two Yosef and Shimons in town, according to the mayor, Edich Simakarti, then look, you're anyway going to have to write the grandparents' name in the get and names in the get or something like that. According to the Lazar, Edim Asira Karti, then anyway, the Edim Asira will be able to say who's which husband and wife we're talking about over here. So Tosfos discusses the details about that, which opinion are we talking, and the answer is basically, yeah, we're talking according to Rabbi Elazar. Edom Estida Kauti, what we're saying is, in other words, that the concern is that, again, Yosef and Shimon, the first Yosef and Shimon Goldstein is going to give the get to Yosef and Shimon Silverstein's wife, and they're not going to know. They're going to know their first names. They don't know that this Yosef and Shimon is not married to this woman. They know the first names, but then afterwards, so the Edom will be able to come and say, look, Yosef and Shimon gave her the get, and they're not going to realize that it was the other Yosef and Shimon. Therefore, so don't we have that concern? To the end, Yoma Kosev Gita, one of them might write a get, but also Lamantula, the it said, hey, Achan is going to go give it to the other one's wife. And then it's going to be misleading, and we're going to think that she was actually divorced. Amalahur of Achabahuna, said of Achabahuna answers them, Hoki Amar Rab, because you should know, Rab said, as a matter of fact, Shnei Yosef and Shimon Adorim Be'irachas, when you have two Yosef and Shimons in one city, Ein Megarshin, Nishasein, Elazel Befnezeh. Precisely, if one of them is going to divorce his wife, he has to do it in the presence of the other one so that we avoid such mix-ups like that. So now, to begin with, when Yosef and Shimon Goldstein wants to divorce his wife, they have to call in, and again, assuming the wives also have the same names, then Yosef and Shimon Silverstein will also need to be present over there, and that way we can make sure that there's no trickery and no misunderstandings and mix-ups going on over there. Again, as Tosfos points out, this is when we have a chazaka that there are two Yosef and Shimons in town. Otherwise, normally, we don't need to do that. The person comes to divorce his wife. We don't need to start investigating in the whole city whether there happens to be another couple with the same names. Still, the Gemara says, so you might have, now you have the situation where a person might go to another town. A person who's not named Yosef ben Shimon is going to go to another town where they don't know him. His real name is Reuven ben Yaakov. He's going to pretend to go. He's going to start going by the name Yosef ben Shimon. Or machzik le'shmei b'Yosef ben Shimon. He starts going by the name Yosef ben Shimon there in the second town. The cost of Gita, he's going to have a get written in that other city on the name Yosef and Shimon, or Mamti Leila Itzed Eyach, and then he's going to give it to Yosef and Shimon's wife in order to cause mix-ups and mess-ups over there. Tosfos also adds the point that it would have to be that he brings along his wife as well, and again his wife comes with him, and they, or at least they know his wife's name, etc. And again, they don't know that this is not the actual Yosef and Shimon. Don't we have that concern that he might do that, and therefore he's going to cause trouble that way? The answer is because Rav Huna bar Chinina tells them, this is what Rav says, whenever a person has been 30 days in town and we have a chazaka that this is his name, then we're not concerned that he might be lying, because he wouldn't be changing his name for that long. He's afraid eventually he might be found out. Sooner or later, somebody's going to come in town and say, hey, that's not Yosef ben Shimon, that's an imposter. So if he's already going by this name for 30 days, then we already can assume that he is who he says he is. And again, if there is in fact another Yosef and Shimon in town, then at that point we'll have to make sure they're both present when a get is being given, and otherwise we're not choshish for it. So the Gemara asks, Lois Chazek, Mai, so what happens if a person has not been in town 30 days and he wants to divorce his wife? What do we do to prevent that there should be fraud like that? What you do is you call out to him by his new name, and if he answers, you know how, so if someone calls out your name and like almost instinctively you turn around, so therefore, so you call him, you call him by surprise by the name that he claims to be. If he answers, if he answers instinctively like that, then it means it really is his real name, because otherwise within 30 days, again, he hasn't even been using this false name for that long, he wouldn't be that used to it yet. On the other hand, Rav Zvid says, no, not necessarily. A cheater is very careful with his cheating. He might actually be very, very careful to train himself, basically, that when they call him by that name, that he'll answer right away. So therefore, Rav Zvid says, no. So if a guy is in town less than 30 days, there's no way around it. You can't write a get for such a person. You're going to have to wait until he's actually been in town for 30 days. So we'll continue tomorrow, Beth Hashem, with various things about this, about having to recognize the names of the husband and the wife and what's considered recognition and so forth. We'll resume with that tomorrow, Beth Hashem.
It's Chicago.